In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Today on the I Spy Radio Show, it is the never-ending spending spree. You know, when I moved to Oregon 20 years ago, one of the things that fascinated me was that every year, the news station would send some guy with a stick up to the top of Mount Hood to measure the snow. And every year, he'd shove that pole into the snow and then shake his head, and it just didn't look good. Could be a drought this year. Every year, there just wasn't enough snow, no matter how much we got. Even when it was 105% or 120% of normal, there still wasn't enough. It was a dry snow. And that's kind of how the Democrats are with the budget. Every year, there isn't enough. Even this year, when we have record amounts of revenue, well, it's a dry revenue. So the Democrats want to find new ways to tax and to spend. If you haven't been paying attention, you'll be shocked to hear what the Democrats are doing and how much they're looking to spend despite being in the hole already. I'd like to welcome Newt Bueller. He is a surgeon, a small business owner, and the state representative for the Bend, Oregon area. Currently serves on four committees, healthcare and revenue committees in the House, the Joint Committee on Tax Credits, and the Joint Ways and Means Human Services Subcommittee. Representative Bueller, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mark. I'm really interested in our conversation today.
Yeah, well, you know, for people who aren't in your district or aren't overly familiar with you, how would you describe your politics?
You know, I shy away from kind of any kind of narrow partisan labels. So I'm an independent-minded Republican is the best way I describe myself. I like to look at the problems. People bring me problems all the time. That's the nature of my job. I research, I look at the data, and then I try to make the best decision possible then to solve those problems.
Well, you certainly seem to be a fiscal conservative. And that is one of the reasons why we want to have you on to discuss the debates going on right now within state politics, especially around the money issues. Right now, we're facing roughly a $1.8 billion budget gap. As typical, it seems the Democrats want more taxes and to diversify those taxes, while Republicans seem to be wanting to cut spending and also attract more businesses and therefore raise revenue simply because you've got more people generating that income. In February of 2017, House Speaker Tina Kotek said that 90% of our budget is education, human services, and public safety. And for us to continue what we're doing, we can't do that with our current tax structure. So what does she mean by that when she says our current tax structure, and do they have the votes to change that current tax structure?
Well, there's a lot in that statement, Mark. You know, in my opinion, I do believe in being fiscally conservative, especially when you're dealing with the people's money, and that's what we're spending in Salem, and we should never lose sight of that. But with the highest revenues in state history, over $21 billion, and the lowest unemployment rate that anyone can remember, there really, in my opinion, is no rationale for raising taxes, you know, to balance the budget. It really needs to focus on cost controls. And, you know, there's no mystery to this problem. 10 years ago, if you remember, Governor Kulongoski, when he was leaving office, he didn't do it before then. And, you know, Kulongoski was no fiscal conservative. He came out with a report that he predicted a decade of deficits if we didn't change our free spending ways that had really become the custom in Oregon state government and has continued. And now, you know, he was really right. He predicted the future. The past decade, over the last 4 years, you know, the state budget has been growing much, much faster than the revenues coming in. And that has resulted in the problem we have right now.
It's unfortunate that he believed that but didn't seem to actually take any steps to correct that. I don't remember the state actually cutting a whole lot of spending when Kulongoski was in office. Am I remembering that incorrectly?
No, you're absolutely right. It is deeply disappointing that he rode, you know, his term of office by exacerbating the problem, especially with regards to PERS. You remember, yes. You know, his training was as a labor lawyer, and he was, you know, one who protected and also, and to a certain extent, helped load the PERS board, which made, in my opinion, the decisions that really have gotten into this problem with regards to the large unfunded liability in PERS. But he was brave enough. You have to give him credit. He was brave enough at the end anyway to at least call out to these problems that we've created this decades of deficit where the pay and benefits and spending priorities of the Democrats have markedly outpaced the ability of the state to pay for them. And yeah, they set these expectations in the people of Oregon, and the expectations just can't be met.
No, it can't. You know, commenting like that on the way to office reminds me a little bit of Eisenhower and his warning about the military-industrial complex. And
Mark, I think that's a great comparison, and I do think conscience eventually comes into play, even with someone leaving office, and maybe that's the freest time to let that conscience play out. And I think that's what happened with Governor Kulongoski, and unfortunately, it was ignored by, you know, the Salem Democratic leadership. And the problem is, as you know, as someone with training in finance and in fiscal issues, the longer you put off solving fiscal problems, the harder they are in the future to solve.
That's
it's almost
sure.
like a fire. You know, a small fire is easy to control. A raging wildfire becomes very damaging to try to get under control. And that's where we find ourselves right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, things are getting bad when even Democrats start paying attention to how much is being spent and even start looking for ways to cut spending. One area that is a bit of a surprise that they have targeted is a hiring freeze. And this particularly hits agencies in the education, human services, and public safety. What do you make of this hiring freeze?
Well, I think a hiring freeze is really a blunt instrument. You know, it's not good practices. It's budget 101, some of the things that Governor Brown has proposed. It's really, you know, freshman mistakes with regards to trying to balance a budget. You know, hiring freezes, pay freezes, selling off your capital. And it really avoids making those hard decisions that a leader needs to be able to make and prioritize and reallocate resources. But, you know, across the board, pay freezes and cuts is, you know, really a freshman mistake with regards to trying to get your hand around a fiscal crisis.
Yeah. Let's go and take a break there. Coming up, we're going to be talking about in the middle of budget holes and spending cuts, the state is looking to spend yet more money. More on that with Newt Bueller. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking about state spending today here, and we're doing that with Representative Newt Bueller. He's a surgeon, small business owner, and he is a state representative for Bend, Oregon, currently serving his second term. His website is newtbueller.com. That's KNUTEBUEHLER.com, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com if you didn't catch all that. And before we get going on what I wanted to talk about on this, I wanted to visit a little bit in terms of the spending cuts that they're proposing. And as I looked at that list, once again, it's just, you know, it's like a hostage situation where they're threatening kids and poor people. Are there other areas where the Democrats have not looked at cutting back on spending? In other words, what areas should be cut, but they're just not looking there?
Yeah, well, I think there's lots of them, Mark. But we should also not lose sight that the other way we can get out of this this problem is by being that partner for business success and growing the economy. And
yes,
we certainly left that culture behind in the past. You know, if we just had the average income of our neighbor to the north in Washington, that would bring in $1 billion more per biennium budget cycle. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the other option here. And all for too long, we haven't been that partner for business success, especially with small business, to grow the existing businesses, hire more people at better paying jobs. And since we're such a income tax dependent state, as people's income goes up, that would really be a big benefit to the state of Oregon. But to focus on the cost side of the equation, yeah, and there's two big ones. Now, remember, the vast majority of state spending is on labor, right? You know, state services, government services is very labor dependent. So over 80% of our budget really goes to labor. So you have to look at your labor cost. And there's some real drivers there. You know, the first is pay increases. As soon as Governor Brown got into office, she subsequently negotiated, and I use negotiation very loosely. She essentially placated some of her biggest donors, which were the government employee unions, and gave big pay increases.
Some people may call that a payoff, not placate.
Some would. It increased the pay beyond what was budgeted from the legislature. So that's added several hundred million dollars to our deficit. And then it's become increasingly apparent to at least the Republicans in the Capitol that the health benefits that have been offered to our government employees and teachers are very generous, much more generous than what almost anyone has in the private sector. And that is a area that we have to get under control. And then third is PERS. People have heard about it. Your listeners certainly have heard about it for years, but I don't think the depth and the scale of the problem was fully realized by the public. But Mark, I have to tell you now, I think they really get it. You know, we have that $22 billion unfunded liability, and you hear that number, but you don't really realize the significance until you start seeing what it does to our operating budget. That means the teachers in the classroom. So as a concrete example, just the increased dollars that has to go to fund PERS this budget cycle in Bend Lapine schools where I represent means that we have 50 fewer teachers just to fund the increased PERS contribution.
Wow.
So those are areas that we need to really focus our efforts, and I think we can rein in some of this deficit we have. And on top of that, we have programs that, just have been poorly managed for years. You know, think about all the waste of Cover Oregon, the Columbia River Crossing, the Business Energy Tax Credit Program, which was really a, you know, a complex corporate cronyism scam that cost the state $1 billion. $1 billion. That's with a B, $1 billion. Poorly managed, ill-conceived.
Oh, absolutely. So right in the middle of this nearly $2 billion budget hole and potential cutting in spending, the legislators looking to pass a big transportation bill, and there seems to be a lot of work on this. I mean, it almost sounds like in some ways they've spent a lot of the legislative cycle compiling this report and plan. So far, what figure is being discussed as the cost of this bill? I mean, how much are we looking at spending here?
Yes, that's a complex question, Mark. The bill hasn't been written yet. So we're almost at the end of the session, mid-May. The bill hasn't been written yet. All we have, at least all I have seen to this point, is just a PowerPoint presentation. And in that power presentation, by last count, and it keeps on changing, this is a little bit like quicksand, some of the discussions on these tax proposals. There's, you know, four or five different taxes or tax increases contained just in the transportation package.
Wow.
We're talking about a new vehicle tax, a tax on gravel, a tax on the sale of bikes, increasing of the gas tax, and then increased tolls on our highways. That is estimated to raise about $5 billion. Now, I'm no big fan of all these tax increases, but I do think your listeners and all of us agree that we've underinvested in our transportation infrastructure for a number of years.
Well,
I think just driving around the state.
That's because cars are evil.
to some cars are evil, but now they're going to put a sales tax even on bikes. So I don't know how to rectify that one. But
So the
transportation package is complex. I'm not sure it's going to get through, lots to come on that.
So it sounds like it's going to cost about $5 billion, and most of that will be paid for via new taxes, correct?
Yeah, and increase in the gas tax.
Okay, so once again, we're at a situation of trust because we've been down this road before, pardon the pun. But we get these set-asides to pay for roads via the gas tax and everything else, and it never gets spent on that. I mean, it's the same thing with the lottery that was supposed to pay for out of schools, and now all of a sudden there's 500 other things it seems like lottery dollars are being spent on. So do we have any assurances that these new taxes would, in fact, pay for these roads and not be diverted to some other program?
Or mismanagement. Yeah. So with regards to road revenue, so such as things as gas tax and tolls and those types of things. We do have assurance, constitutional assurance, that that has to go to road and bridges and what we call infrastructure. So that can't be taken off for other goals. But what my concern is, ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation, has a long history of mismanagement.
Yes.
You know, huge projects that have gone bad. You know, the highway, you know, one of the most expensive highway projects in the state's history gone bad, which is the highway from Newport to Corvallis, hundreds of millions of dollars of cost overruns there. And then ODOT itself has have problems with conflict of interest and leadership problems. They couldn't, for whatever reasons, incompetence more than anything, couldn't even get an audit done for almost a year because of conflict of interest problems and difficulty even getting that analysis out to bid. So yeah. I do have a degree of hesitation of sending billions of dollars more revenue to a state agency, which right now I have concerns about leadership and management problems.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All right, we're up against a break here. And we'll stay with us. We'll wrap things up with Newt Bueller. Stay with us.
Get a little more intelligence on big government. This is the iSpy Radio Show.
And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Keep an eye on big government, and we're talking about state spending today. And we're wrapping things up here with Representative Newt Bueller, a surgeon, small business owner, and the state rep for Bend, Oregon. His website is newtbueller.com, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. Just look for today's show page. That is 720 if you're looking in the archives. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about messaging here, because you are quoted as saying that people are deeply unhappy with the status quo. They're unhappy with their lot in life. Our middle class has been hollowed out. That great American escalator to a higher quality of life has stopped. You might even say that it's running in reverse. And this is from a Steve Dunn interview, and I think that's Oregonian. So if your statement is true, why aren't we a red state with a red governor?
Well, I think there's a long history in Oregon of democratic rule, and that sets the political culture. And I think it takes time for that kind of culture to change. And the best way to drive change in culture is to have good leadership that is able to articulate a new vision and an optimistic way forward. And I think we desperately need that in Oregon.
Oh, absolutely. You know, if nothing else, you in the last segment there, we were talking about how we're looking at changing our sales, we're looking at adding a sales tax and changing some of the tax structure versus what the Republicans want to do, which is grow that pot of money, grow the revenue sources. And it seems like so much of the legislature, people serving in it, just don't seem to get that concept that as a state, we are in a competitive environment, where we're competing with Washington, we're competing with Idaho, we're competing with California, and now, thanks to the internet, we're competing with states all across the nation. And when we try to shove these new taxes on people, it is like two stores on opposite sides of the street. One says everything on sale 25% off versus what Oregon seems to do, which is everything now 25% more expensive. So why is it that people in the legislature itself don't get that?
Well, some people do, Mark. I think the Democratic leadership certainly doesn't understand it. You know, I'm on what's called the Tax Reform Committee, which is I've quickly seen turned into the Tax Increase Committee. I think we've had four or five different proposals with regards to gross receipts tax, which was like Measure 97, which is functions like a hidden sales tax. And you bring up a great point. This is a very competitive world we live in right now, not only internationally, but between states. And we're competing for labor and capital. We want the best quality and talented people coming to Oregon. And we want those investors investing their money here to build this state. I mean, Oregon, I think, really has the potential to be an economic powerhouse, to really be that best place in the nation to live, work, and play. Just look around us. It's a beautiful place to live. We have wonderful ports. We still have great natural resources. We have creative people. We shouldn't be struggling. We shouldn't be some of the worst states in the nation in terms of income growth and graduation rates and the quality of our education, we should be some of the best. And it should be a great place to live. You know, we should have the money and the free time to enjoy the great food and beer and wine all around us. And it's just not that way.
No, it is not. And I absolutely agree with you. We have all of the potentials there, but we're not capitalizing on any of those. And a big one is the timber industry. I have a builder friend who said that since the Trump election, his business has increased 1,000%. And we have a prime opportunity now to start logging some of these forests that have sat there idle, that are going to rot and going to waste or catching on fire and burning up anyway. So is there any inclination within the state legislature to start opening up more land to timber harvest?
I sure hope so. You know, our forests have been mismanaged, like our state, for several decades now. Many of them are really just tinder boxes ready to go up in flames. And the ironic part of that, Mark, is that the leading cause of greenhouse gas production now in the state of Oregon is forest fires.
Yeah.
So we need
Isn't
to get
ironic?
This problem on. Yeah, it's very ironic. And there's wonderful new technology that really could provide a boom to the Oregon timber industry. And that's, you know, cross-laminated timber construction, you know, big multi-story buildings made with wood. Oregon is ideally positioned to lead the world in that technology and essentially rejuvenate our timber economy.
And also to do that in a responsible way. I mean, that is certainly on the minds of so many Oregonians that, yes, we do want timber harvest, but there's another portion of Oregonians that say, well, we need to do this responsibly. Okay, so let's find a way to do that. And like you say, we should be leading the way in this.
Right. And you know, it's a wonderful opportunity to improve the environment. You know, the best carbon sink, you know, to take the carbon out of the environment is really trees and putting up buildings with their construction instead of producing a bunch of carbon by making cement buildings. So Oregon could contribute mightily to decreasing carbon in our environment if we were just smart about it. Instead, we let our forests go up in flames and release all that carbon and greenhouse gas into the environment.
Yeah, I only have about 30 seconds here with you. You've said that roughly, Oregon is 75% reliant on income taxes. The obvious solution is to generate more state revenue for education. Is there any sense that the Democrats are going to get their way in terms of pushing through sales tax or some of these other hidden taxes?
If the Republicans hold strong, they still need a one single Republican vote to pass a sales tax or a gross receipts tax. I'm confident that at least in the House, we're united. Unless we see meaningful and long-term cost controls, there will be no Republican votes for any hidden sales tax.
Terrific. All right, Newt Bueller, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Mark. It's wonderful being on your show.
All right, thank you. Take care. And coming up next, Jonathan Williams of ALEC. The grades are in. Guess how Oregon's doing? And also, at the end of the show, I do have a disclaimer about Newt. Be sure to hang around for that. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show, talking today about the never-ending spending spree, especially what happens here in good old Oregon. And I'd like to talk now to Jonathan Williams. He is the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform at the American Legislative Exchange Council. That's ALEC, A-L-E-C. They also publish the Rich States, Poor States annual report, and of which he is one of the co-authors. Jonathan, it's always good to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me back on the show. And I always say greetings from the land of make-believe Washington, D.C., but today I'm actually coming from Utah, the number one state in America for economic outlook.
Yeah, we definitely want to talk about Utah a little bit later in the show here. But, you know, you guys have this report, and the 10th edition just came out recently. And you guys look at 15 equally weighted economic outlook variables, but you don't really look at the spending side of things so much. You do look at how much a state spends on things like debt service, how much they pay for interest on loans and so forth, but you guys don't seem to look too much at how much a state spends overall, perhaps as a percentage of income, that sort of thing. Can you talk to us a bit about why you don't focus more on state spending when you put together your analysis?
Well, you know, at the state level, spending and taxation is really the really two sides of the same fiscal coin. There are some things states can do to defer and not spend and carry debt in some cases, but it's not like states have printing presses, and they do have at least ostensibly balanced budget amendments. And so, you know, we look a lot on the tax side of the variables, as you know, and we look at the debt and a few of those things. But I wouldn't be surprised if over time, as we continue to, you know, tweak the index to make it representative of new policy developments, that wouldn't be surprised if we saw some additional things on the spending side or the pension side of the equation.
Well, we just talked with Newt Bueller, who talked about some of Oregon's plans, especially the fact that we've got this $2 billion budget deficit that we're facing. The state is, I mean, things are so serious here in Oregon that the Democrats are even talking about doing some cuts. So you know it's going to be bad then. But despite that $2 billion budget deficit, they're still talking about spending a huge amount on infrastructure. And to me, it sounds like the old shovel-ready jobs fiasco of the Obama spending spree. Does spending on infrastructure create economic booms?
Well, when you look at spending, when you look at, you know, cutting taxes, you know, it all matters. The degree of which it matters is really the important factor, because, you know, you can subsidize things for people to grow oranges in Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and you can get some economic activity out of it. But is it the best way to go about getting some sort of, you know, boost to the economy? Same thing with infrastructure. Sure, you're going to see an immediate effect in some cases. There's going to be a few people that are going to have jobs, or going to be raw materials purchased. But is that the most effective way of going about spending resources that are obviously scarce at the end of the day? That's the first law of economics, scarcity of resources. We wish we had enough to go around, but we never do. And so I think then the question for policymakers is a dollar spent, or in this case, maybe millions of dollars spent on infrastructure, something, and what is it, the trade-off that you're giving to get that? So I think that's really the question. And infrastructure at the end of the day, though, was proved by the failure of the shovel-ready phenomenon during the Obama administration, with the stimulus, you know, maybe created some short-term jobs, but did not give us a real boost to the economy that was sorely needed at the time and still is.
Well, there just seems to be a fallacy of thinking that way. It reminds me a lot of Bastiat's broken window theory, where we're taking income that we've already received in the forms in the form of taxes, and now we're spending that supposedly creating jobs, but you're not really creating new jobs. I mean, to me, what you're really creating is obligations, because what happens when the shovel-ready jobs run out of? I mean, when there are no more roads to fix.
Well, right, exactly. And if it was all about job creation, as the Milton Friedman famous line was, well, why don't you stop digging ditches with shovels and start digging with spoons, right? Because that's a full employment act then. And so it's really the question of what are you getting for those dollars invested? And at the end of the day, you know, so many of these quote-unquote needs for things like infrastructure in some cases are anything but needs. They're just wants, and they're things that, you know, in some cases repaving roads that have been paved not that long ago. So I think it gets down to the fundamental budget discussion that we often have with lawmakers, is needs versus wants, priorities of government. And if it fits those things, then in some cases, then obviously infrastructure is a good investment. But just be careful, because it's not going to be this long-term economic boom that some people suggest it might.
Yeah, well, like I said, I think it's just flawed thinking. I think it was Churchill that said that it's like standing in a bucket and hoping to lift yourself up, because you're spending money that you've already collected. Versus let's cut taxes and regulations to allow for more businesses to come in. We're spending tax money rather than creating new money that can then be taxed. Here in Oregon, we always have a budget deficit. And from my seat in the peanut gallery, it's because we overproject the revenue and then budget to spend 100% of that mythical number. Are there states that build out their projections and then spend only, say, 90% of that or 75% of that to create a safety net, and then they'll bank the excess?
Yeah, there certainly are. I mean, there's a good number of states that take a more prudent approach. I mean, first step there is obviously getting revenue estimates that you can depend upon. And it's not going to be gamed by the political machines that often are, you know, trying to, you know, bend the numbers to either argue for the need to raise taxes or the ability to spend more money. And that's really part of the issue, is when you have politically motivated revenue estimates, there's no end to the games that can be played there. But you're your point is a good one, and there are, in fact, Alec calls for the idea that you should not appropriate 100% of available revenue, that you should leave a cushion there in case, you know, you have a downturn or unexpected blip in the radar, that you're not, you know, then coming back to taxpayers and asking for more. And government overall, both federal, state, and local levels, does a very poor job in many cases of doing that forecasting correctly and not basically protecting it from the political will that always does crave to spend and tax more.
Well, here in Oregon, I think we have a pretty bad track record of our projections for the coming biennium. You know, when your projections are wrong, when you dedicate 100% of that spending, you're going to just, I mean, it's just, it's a car accident waiting to happen, unfortunately. All right, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up, we're going to be talking about those rich states and poor states. We're going to be starting off with the bad, and Oregon is in the bottom 10 again. Find out why after this.
Stay informed. News, information, and all our past shows are available on iSpyRadio.com.
And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. Talk today to Jonathan Williams, talking about economics. And earlier in the show, we had talked with Newt Bueller, and that was more about spending and what is going on here in Oregon. And Jonathan Williams is with the American Legislative Exchange Council. That's ALEC.org, if you'd like to go visit them. And they also publish the Rich States, Poor States Annual Report, and that is a ranking of the states and their competitiveness in terms of their economic outlook. And I'd like to start with the bad, unfortunately, because once again, Oregon is in that bottom 10. We had crept down we had been in the 30s, I think, when we had first started talking with you, and now we've been consistently in the 40s. This year we come out number 41, but then also on rounding out the bottom 10, we've got Maine, Hawaii, Illinois, Minnesota, Connecticut, California, New Jersey, Vermont, and in the bottom of the pile, New York State. So is there a common denominator here or a driver as to why states continue to fall to the bottom?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Those the states in the bottom 10, of course, as you've lived this in Oregon, so you know this to be absolutely true, is they're states in perpetual budget deficits. They're states that, by the way, have some of the highest tax rates in the country. So there's this dichotomy. They have some of the highest taxes, yet they always have budget problems. So what does that suggest? They're states that don't know how to prioritize spending as well as many of the other states, and they're always going back to taxpayers and asking for more. And there's this idea, you know, Ronald Reagan talked about the planks of the liberal view of the economy. If it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. If it stops moving, subsidize it. So there are states that engage in a lot of cronyism because they're trying to make up for their high tax rates on everybody across the board and then trying to pick special winners and losers and favorites in the tax codes. And so we're seeing, you know, a lot of these states carve up their tax bases and then want to put out press releases and ribbon-cutting ceremonies as to look what big government just gave you, you know, like it was their money to give in the first place. So that's really the philosophy, is they really do empower big government, they disempower individual taxpayers, and their states that are racking up a whole lot of debt when it comes to spending and pensions.
Well, and I also noticed that there's kind of a common denominator in there as well, that many of those states are democratically controlled. Oregon is one, Hawaii, Illinois, I think Minnesota, Connecticut, California, Vermont, and then New York. The only one that really is escaping that is New Jersey, but they've got Chris Christie. But I think the majority of their legislature is Democrat, isn't it?
Yeah, in New Jersey, Chris Christie has never had a Republican legislature his entire 7 years now. And he's vetoed a lot of very bad things like millionaires' taxes that you all have dealt with, of course, in Oregon in past years. I mean, there's some truth to that, that there's a lot of liberal governance in those states. You know, we do have some Republican governors now in Illinois with Bruce Rauner and some of those now that are trying to peel back a lot of the bad policy that existed before them. But, you know, it does take a couple of different branches to tango. It takes, you know, a legislative, it takes an executive branch, and it takes a judicial branch that isn't going to be an activist branch that tries to stop pro-taxpayer reforms. And so, you know, it's a complicated picture on how the politics have evolved in all those states. And it's, you know, not quite as simple as Republican versus Democrat. It's more about, I think, the governing philosophy, because we've worked with some fine Democrats over the years. In fact, there was one ALEC member in Illinois, a Democrat, who was the one vote who stopped a progressive income income tax from happening in Illinois, and stood up to his own Speaker of the House there. So we've seen some good movement in some of those states, but you're right. These are states that have struggled, and they've struggled for a very long time in many cases.
Well, that was actually where I was going to go. Is what is it with the Democrats and the majority of them, I should say, because as you mentioned, there are a few fiscally conservative Democrats out there. But why is it that with the majority of Democrats, they just think that they can tax and spend and there not be any ramifications to that?
Well, and you know, this is kind of liberal ideology 101, is that, you know, people don't move based on tax factors. You can get away with taxing as much as you want, and it's going to be completely fine. And you know, they look at our research from rich states, poor states,
you know,
and just ignore it. And
that's kind of like saying it's okay to beat your slaves because you know they can't escape the plantation.
It's horrible. I mean, it's a completely wrong-headed way to look at it. And unfortunately, though, you know, so for so many cases, especially you get to the liberal Bay Area or you get to Manhattan in New York, and you know, these elected officials think that they're a luxury good and that people will pay more to go and live in those places. And they don't realize, though, that a lot of the policies they're putting in place, and you see this in Oregon with Portland, is, you know, those areas might do fine with the more liberal policies, but when you really adopt those liberal policies across the state, you kill the areas that are outside of those major liberal city centers, the suburbs, the rural areas, and you look at places, let's say upstate New York, where I just was this week. I mean, some of those places look like Detroit with the depopulation, the loss of industrial ability and business in those cases. You look at the Central Valley of California, same thing. And so you kind of have that limousine liberal crowd from those big cities that thinks that, you know, these policies don't really have an effect because, oh, look at our streets are bustling in the big cities, but what those policies have meant for the outlying areas in the state has just been devastating.
Yeah. Well, I still have family that live in the Jamestown, New York area, and when I've been back there, even just a couple of years ago, it's like the roads, they're testing missiles on it. I mean, it is just amazing how terrible their infrastructure is. In terms of Oregon, what do we need to do to improve?
Well, how long is your show today, Mark?
Well, you got about a minute.
There's a lot of issues. You know, there are a lot of issues. The big ones are obviously, you know, the income tax rates are the most damaging way to raise revenue for state-level government spending. You know, you need to raise revenue somehow, but raising it so heavily based on income taxes like you do in Oregon is very damaging. You have some of the top five highest personal and corporate income tax rates in America, one of the most progressive income tax systems in America, which creates the boom and bust cycle, which kind of leads into this perpetual budget shortfall issue that you've talked about, you know, not having a right to work status, having a state level death tax. I mean, those are all things that many states are moving away from, going in the other direction. And Oregon stuck with some very, very bad policies across the board, whether you look at the taxes, the labor policy, the regulation. And that's why, you know, you find yourself once again in the bottom 10 in rich states, poor states.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately. Okay, let's take a break. Coming up, we'll be into our last segment with Jonathan Williams of ALEC. And coming up, we'll be talking about something Oregon can maybe imitate. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're into our final segment now with Jonathan Williams, the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform at American Legislative Exchange Council. Their website is alec.org, and they also have a new website, richstatespoorstates.org, if you want to go visit that. And so, Jonathan, let's end on a good note. The states where things are likely to be looking up this year, the top 10 are number one, Utah, Indiana, North Carolina, North Dakota, Tennessee, Florida, Wyoming, Arizona, Texas, and Idaho. Same question here as last time. Is there a common denominator or driver why states will rise to the top for their economic outlook?
Well, I think it really is. And being here in Salt Lake City today, celebrating 10 years with Utah at number one, I mean, their formula has been pretty clear over the years. And that has been, when they have a budget shortfall, their first reaction is they do not go back to taxpayers and ask for more automatically. They look to try to find ways within the budget to reprioritize, to make sure that they're not asking more and raising the price of doing business and raising the price of living in Utah during tough times. And of course, they've gone through tough times like everyone else has. But yeah, I think that's one of the big lessons lessons of the states that do well. Another is that Utah and so many of these states have started to tackle the big debt and unfunded pension obligations that threaten Oregon and so many other states. As Utah was really one of the leaders back about 5 years ago and transitioned to more of the 401k style plans, and has really helped to keep Utah competitive and give it that staying power to be at number one for all those years. And then, you know, you have the states like North Carolina and Indiana who have been very, very impressive, have moved from the mid-20s up to number two and number three respectively, and they've just done it through aggressive tax cutting. When they have extra revenue, they plowed into reducing the price of work and doing business in the state, and it's been a great formula for those two states. I mean, North Carolina has done probably the most on tax reform of any state in the last couple of decades, and they've got the economic results to back it up, a big surplus, AAA bond rating, and lots of in-migration. So, I mean, I think North Carolina is one of the shining examples of rich states, poor states over the years.
Well, it's just astonishing that Utah has been first every single year you guys have brought out this report, the 10 years in a row. That's just astonishing. And then right behind them, South Dakota was ranked second in about five out of the 10 years. And then bang, in the last two, they've dropped out of the top 10. What happened to South Dakota?
Well, I think this is an important lesson, is that while we've seen some states with some really upward mobility by doing the right things, you know, sometimes, you know, even states that have been in the top 10 for many years have fell out, because in some cases you can fall behind just by standing still because so many states are moving in the right direction. Over the last 4 years, nearly 30 states have significantly cut taxes that we've tracked. But, you know, South Dakota specifically, they raised a minimum wage on a ballot initiative, as well as they raised their sales tax. And they did not live within their means. And so even though Republicans govern South Dakota, I think they made a big mistake there, and it's really cost them in terms of their economic outlook.
Well, looking ahead for the nation, are you thinking good times or bad times coming from the federal level?
Well, you know, this is if I had the answer to that, boy, I wish I did. But, you know, I think a lot of it's dependent on how successful President Trump and the leadership in Congress is at getting their tax reform and regulatory relief and Obamacare repeal done before 2018. And I think that the markets have basically priced it in. They want to see regulatory relief. They want to see tax reform. In fact, just this week, Chairman Kevin Brady at the House Ways and Means Committee held their first hearing on fundamental tax reform. It's been 30 years. It's a long time coming. And if they're successful at getting our business tax rate where it's not the highest in the developed world, getting individual rates down and starting to provide more regulatory certainty for businesses to create jobs again, I'm bullish on what the U.S. economy can do. If we fail in those efforts, I think we have some pain ahead when it comes to the markets. I really do, unfortunately.
Well, in terms of Obamacare, have you seen a correlation there between states that have, you know, really gone overboard and jumped into the Obamacare, into them fully? I mean, certainly here in Oregon we did that, versus states that you really tried to keep Obamacare at arm's length. Have any correlations there?
Yeah, there are. And then I think certainly in the future, I think is the real worry for the states that, you know, were allured by this quote unquote free federal money, which we know that doesn't exist. Of course, it comes with tons of strings. Somebody suggested to me their chains coming from Washington, and they have put lots of requirements on states. And what happens when the federal dollars go away, which we know that they will, and the match goes down from 100 to 90 to maybe 50% match. I mean, those policymakers in those states that have expanded Medicaid under Obamacare and have gone kind of full bore into Obamacare, they're going to be left holding the bag. And at the end of the day, that means taxpayers in those states are going to be left holding the bag, and it's going to mean major future tax increases. So I'm very disappointed by kind of that movement. And I think taxpayers are going to take it on the chin in many of those cases, unless we can kind of get this thing figured out at the federal level and give states more flexibility back with the block grant concept, I think is the right way to go.
Well, Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for your time. It's always interesting and fascinating. And again, if people want to look up your reports, just simply head to richstatespoorstates.org. Jonathan, thanks again.
Hey, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
All right, bye-bye. Before we go, you may have seen that Newt Bueller, one of our guests today, put up a Facebook post that was very disrespectful and disparaging of the president. As a result, I considered not running his segments. We did, but I want you to know that in no way do I condone Newt's comments, especially comments that are based on anonymous sources, especially in light of last week's show on how George Soros buys journalists to sow seeds of suspicion and doubt about the elected government. Newt made good sense on fiscal issues, and I support him on that. His comments, though, smacked of political opportunism, as though by disparaging President Trump that this would somehow score points with Democrats. If someone does have eyes on higher office, don't insult the candidate supported by more than 85% of your own party. That's not a way to get elected, and only prevents other Republicans from getting elected. That's not leadership. And if Newt wants to come back on to explain himself, he's welcome to get a hold of us. Check out our all-new website and share our page with others. Help us spread our reach to fight back against the misinformed. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.